in any right to engage in an activity or to perform an act aimed at the destruction of any of the rights and freedoms set forth herein.
Well, if that were actually implemented, it would mean that anyone in any government anywhere in the world who limited anyone's right to vote, to eat, to have an education, would be doing something not illegal, but wrong. This is not a treaty, so you can't arrest them for that, but that's what it would mean.
But it sounds like it's saying that nothing in this declaration declaring all these various human rights gives anyone the right to deny the rights.
That's exactly what it says. That's exactly what it says. And if it were a law, we could go around arresting practically everybody in government in every part of the world. But it's not a law.
So it's a self-protective. Is it an escape clause?
No, it's not self-protective. My guess is, I don't know about this, that there was a big debate even about putting this in here, because you could extrapolate the way I've just extrapolated. Don't forget, this is a normative statement. At the time when the Nazis persecuted Jews in Germany, that was not illegal. You could do whatever you wanted to citizens of your own state. It was illegal for the Nazis to then go around occupying the rest of Europe. But this is a big step forward at the time. But you're right to draw attention to it, because if it ever were international, actual hard international law, then everybody could be arrested. Right now, political and military leaders, including sitting heads of state, can be arrested under universal jurisdiction for crimes against humanity and genocide. But they can't be arrested simply for denying people in their country their human rights. So you can't arrest the leaders of Iran for denying rights to women, or the leaders of Saudi Arabia, which is actually worse, for denying rights to women. You can't arrest heads of state for depriving indigenous people of their land. None of that is international law at the moment. If this ever were law, it would be wonderful. But it isn't right now. It's just an aspirational statement.
And so the Canadian government has acknowledged the fact that Canada committed genocide against First Nations people, but nobody can be tried for it.
Well, yeah, you can't. I mean, first of all, you can't try people who are dead. I'm not sure if the Canadian government has actually acknowledged genocide. Yeah, but you can't. You can't do it. You cannot arrest the Canadian government now for continued massive incarceration of Indigenous people, for underfunding their educational programs, for underfunding their child welfare programs. All those things that are now currently going through the courts or are part of a lot of national discussion. You can't arrest Justin Trudeau for doing that, for being the head of state, for those kinds of things. No.
Rhoda Hassman, last question. What's the relevance of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights today on the occasion of the 70th anniversary of its passage, the 75th anniversary of its passage?
It's an aspirational document to which many activists for their human rights pay attention. They can use it. They can say to their governments, you signed on to this document, so we want our rights. It's also the basis for a lot of international law. As we've already discussed, laws against torture, laws against racial discrimination. So it has real relevance there as well. And sometimes it's used as basis for human rights in foreign policy. And sometimes it's used as a basis for states to criticize other states at the UN, perhaps utterly hypocritically. But occasionally, researchers have shown that some states, especially those that want more legitimacy in the international arena, will change their policies. So, and it's also used, for example, by the European Court of Human Rights, by the American Court of Human Rights, Latin American document, and even by the African Union, which has an African document on human rights. So it's a very long, slow process. You have to compare the world now to the world 75 years ago and see that a lot of changes have occurred, even though especially if you're a younger person, you may be extremely impatient about that. I, as an older person, am also impatient. I would like everyone in the world to enjoy all their human rights right now, but sadly they don't.
Rhoda Hassman, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Rhoda Howard Hassman is a Canadian social scientist specializing in international human rights from 2003 to 2016. She held the Canada Research Chair in International Human Rights at Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Ontario. In June 2023, Hassman was appointed to the Order of Canada. Listen to my complete conversation with Rhoda Hassman, including her thoughts on the denial of food rights in North Korea, Zimbabwe, Venezuela, and the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, please subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. According to the Universal Declaration, everyone has the right to life, liberty, and personal security. No one shall be subjected to arbitrary arrest or detention, it says, or to degrading treatment, punishment, or torture. All human beings are equal before the law, presumed innocent until proven guilty, well defended in a public trial. In the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories, these rights are routinely and systematically denied. Since the start of Israel's belligerent occupation 55 years ago, the Israeli military has jailed an estimated million Palestinians, typically inside Israel proper, in flagrant violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, often without charge. Palestinian prisoners are routinely abused, denied food and medical treatment, and tortured. Hundreds of youths and children are detained each year. I spoke about Israel's carceral system with Milena Ansari. Ansari is international advocacy officer with the Adamir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association, a Palestinian NGO based in Ramallah, occupied Palestine. Tell me about Adamir. What does Adamir do?
So we're a civil society, a human rights organization. As I mentioned, we focus on Palestinian political prisoners, but it's important to note that we focus on Palestinian political prisoners held both in Israeli occupation prisons and the Palestinian Authority as well. So we provide free legal aid to the detainees and their families. We also advocate on their behalf on an international level. So doing reporting to the United Nations, to the ICC as well, the International Criminal Court, briefings with representatives to highlight issues of concerns regarding prisoners or certain cases of Palestinian prisoners. We also have a legal research and documentation unit that they do regular prison visits and interviews with prisoners and former prisoners and their families to document the systematic violations of Palestinian prisoners' rights. So this includes solitary confinement, torture and ill-treatment, medical neglect inside Israeli prisons, harsh detention conditions, because Israeli prisons are characterized that they are inadequate for human living. They lack the adequate living standards for any human being. So there's harsh detention conditions. And of course, for legal services, we really focus on administrative detention, which is a procedure that the Israeli occupation uses to detain Palestinians without charges, without trial, based on secret information and for an indefinite time. So the Israeli military commander issues an order that's called an administrative detention order that says this person may impose a future risk to the security of Israel, so we should detain them inside prison to avoid any security threats. But of course, there is absolutely no security threat. It is mainly to maintain control over the Palestinians. And I say this because for 30 years, we've seen administrative detention being used against children, against women, civil society actors, where the Israeli occupation fails to provide a list of charges. So they go to administrative detention where they just say secret information and the military judge confirms the order and the person is in detention for an indefinite time.
How many Palestinian prisoners is Israel now holding in jail?
So there are around 4,600 Palestinian political prisoners in general. 600 of them are administrative detainees, so held without charge, without trial, for an indefinite time.
And many of these are held inside prisons within the Green Line.
Exactly. So there are 18 Israeli occupation prisons where Palestinians are held, and only one is located inside the West Bank. Ofar prison. The rest are all located inside Israel, which is in violation of international humanitarian law, because this is considered the crime of forcibly transferring prisoners of the occupied territory outside of their territory.
Prisoners detained by the occupying power
inside
must be detained within the borders of the occupied territory.
Yeah, and this is not the only violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, because Israeli military courts are also implementing Israeli laws and legislation and procedures against Palestinians. And of course, you cannot enforce the occupied powers' legislation on the occupied people. And I say this because Israeli military orders that are the basis, that act as the law, the legislation in the occupied territory, criminalize almost every aspect of a Palestinian life. So when Israeli military orders are used in military courts, there's always no chance for true justice or accountability in these military courts, because the judge is an Israeli military officer, the prosecutor is an Israeli military officer, the language spoken is Hebrew, a language Palestinians don't know, and the law that's used against them is Israeli military law. So the whole system is built so no true justice is given to Palestinians. Just one information, Beit Salem, which is an Israeli human rights organization, this is a statistic from them that says the conviction rate in Israeli military courts for Palestinians is 99.7%. So you can understand that there's no actual rule of law being implemented. It's just a system that plays an integral role in delegitimizing the Palestinian people and the right to self-determination in general.
And what are the conditions of those prisoners inside of Israeli jails?
So Israeli prisons where Palestinians are held there arbitrarily, mainly they are described as overcrowded, lack of sufficient ventilation and natural lighting. So when I say overcrowding, we mean more than 8 prisoners in a cell that doesn't fit more than 4 or more than 6. Inside prisons, there's absolutely no proper food. The prisoners are left to cook their own food, and they are given certain amount each day or each week, and they cook their own. But that being said, there's complete medical neglect in Israeli prison services, where Palestinian prisoners, if they have sustained injuries prior to their arrest, or they have chronic illnesses, they are not given the proper treatment as the Geneva Conventions clearly state. Inside Israeli prisons, there's definitely this policy of deliberate medical neglect, where the Israeli prison services doesn't provide the Palestinians with the proper treatment. An example of this is the case of Jamal Zaid. Jamal Zaid is an elderly Palestinian who's under administrative detention. So he's detained without charge, without trial, based on secret information. And he was arrested from September 2021. And he is undergoing dialysis because he has kidney failure and other health conditions like high blood pressure. And now I can't think of them, but I think he has diabetes as well. So even a person who's suffering from medical conditions can be detained in Israeli prisons without a list of charges, without trial. So the Israeli prison services were aware of Jamal's condition and that he has to undergo dialysis 3 times a week. So he's held in a Ramle prison clinic. So Ramleh Prison Clinic is reported by the prisoners as the slaughterhouse. It is far from any clinic or medical facility that anyone can imagine.
And it's inside of Israel.
It's in Ramleh, yes. It's like in the occupied 1948 territories, if we want to be accurate with the definitions. So even when he's undergoing dialysis, inside the prison clinic, they don't have a proper medical staff. There's no full medical staff on board all the time. What the Israeli prison services do as well is they keep at least 3 Palestinian prisoners who are healthy and well to take care of the other sick and wounded or ill prisoners. So in Jamal's case, the dialysis session takes around 4 hours. And this is completely medical neglect because it shouldn't be taking that long. And the transport from the dialysis room to back to his room in the Ramleh prison clinic entails a lot of harshness. Because they are still shackled by their hands and feet at the whole time. And even if they want to be transferred to an Israeli hospital for better treatment, in a way, and I'm using quotes, because it's still arbitrary treatment, the transportation, the trip to the prison clinic, to the hospital, takes long hours, and they are transferred by something that's called Bosta. Many Palestinian prisoners always report on their experiences and hardship in El Bosta, which is basically a metal vehicle that transports the prisoners from the prison to clinic or the court. So it's a really degrading and harsh trip. So Jamal Zaid decided to boycott the dialysis sessions because he said the treatment in these clinics is arbitrary and I'm detained with no reasons and no charges. So now Jamal is not boycotting the dialysis sessions anymore because he missed 3 sessions and that really affected and deteriorated his health conditions. So I mean, it was either he will completely, I don't want to say it, or he continues with the dialysis session. But even when prisoners use hunger strikes to put pressure on the Israeli occupation, the Israeli occupation doesn't care. It doesn't understand the gravity of the situation or arbitrariness. We have hunger striking detainees who reached 100 days without food. And this only shows that the IPS don't really care what happens to a prisoner's life.
How many children, how many minors are being held in Israeli prisons?
170.
At this moment?
Yes. And one, the case of Ahmed Manasra was one of these numbers. And I would like to highlight the case of Ahmed Manasra, who was arrested when he was 13 years old. Until now, he's in Israeli prisons. I think he served 7 years now. Ahmed's case.
So he's 20 years old now, and he was 13 when he was first arrested.
Yes, he became a teenager. He became a man inside Israeli prisons. But his case is brutal, because, and I'll be honest, and I'll tell you the case from the beginning. He was arrested while in Jerusalem for allegedly planning to stab, an incident of stabbing. And we're talking about a 13-year-old boy here. That's really important to always bear in mind. He was with his cousin, who during the incident or the attack, because it's all allegations, there hasn't been any concrete evidence that show. But regardless of that, his cousin, who was a child as well with him, was killed. So he died during the attack itself. And Ahmed was subjected, so he saw his cousin being killed and died at that time.
And when was this? When did this happen?
I'm not sure exactly of the date, but if we say 7 years from now, so yeah. But his case is also online. There's an ongoing campaign for the case of Ahmed Manasra, because during interrogation, there is a video clip of his interrogation. The Israeli interrogator was psychologically abusing Ahmed Manasra as a child during interrogation. There were no lawyers present. There was constant screaming and yelling and cursing at Ahmed, cursing his family, cursing himself directly, and Ahmed kept saying, I don't remember. I don't know what happened. I can't remember. My head hurts. Because during the incident as well, he sustained a head injury in his skull. So he had a few injuries in his head as well. And he kept saying, I can't. I don't remember. I can't. It hurts. My head hurts. And the interrogator kept yelling and screaming on and on. But the case becomes more arbitrary when the Israeli prison services put Ahmed in solitary confinement for more than 5 years because he was facing psychological conditions inside prison. Because if you can imagine a 13-year-old being subjected to ill treatment in interrogation and seeing his cousin passing away exactly during his arrest, and also being sentenced to 9 years inside Israeli prison without the proper treatment for children, because children have a vulnerability. For the Convention for the Rights of Children says that the deprivation of liberty for children should come as a last resort, and it should be for a small duration of time. Children should not be in solitary confinement. But Ahmed Wanasra was subjected to so many ill treatment and torture that he had psychological health conditions. His health condition is seriously bad, that he's not aware of his surroundings. And the Israeli prison services are putting him in solitary confinement because they say he might be a threat or a threat to the prisoners inside prison. So instead of properly treating Ahmed and providing him with the treatment that he needs, the Israeli prison services' solution is to put him in solitary confinement, isolated from everyone and from support and from human interaction.
Am I correct that something approaching 40% of the male Palestinian population have spent time in Israeli jails?
In every family in Palestine, for sure you will have one family member that was either arrested, detained, or imprisoned. So yes, there is a high number of Palestinian male prisoners.
I mean, there's hardly a family in Palestine.
Exactly,
there's hardly a Palestinian family who hasn't had at least one member of their family jailed for extensive periods of time.
Definitely.
And there are many, many Palestinians, particularly Palestinian males, who've been in and out of prisons on and off since they were children and have had experiences, have been detained on multiple occasions over the course of their life. So the burden of imprisonment in Israeli jails, the population kind of burden, is huge, isn't it?
Yes, so I will talk about the male prisoners and their conditions of detention, but it's really important to bear in mind that although there are only 32 female prisoners, but Palestinian women prisoners are subjected to more gender-based violences than male prisoners, which mainly during interrogation, during the strip searches, inside the prison themselves, because most of the Palestinian women prisoners, or there is a good number of women prisoners who wear the headscarf inside prison, and the prison guards are mainly male prison guards. So inside prison, Palestinians are women are not afforded the privacy or the respect of their life in general. But again, it's more about the gender-based violences during interrogation, the psychological torture, threats of rape, the invasive body searches, and all that. But that being said, the majority of prisoners are male prisoners, because the Israeli occupation understands the important role of males in an Arab society. They are the support for the families. They are the fathers, the brothers. I'm not in any way undermining the role of women, because they are the mothers and the root of resistance and solidarity in Palestine. But they target males because they want them to understand that Israel is in control. To keep in mind that regardless of what happens, if you try to resist through throwing stones, or if you try to resist through being in an organization like Al-Damir that does civil society work, you will be targeted because you are criminalized as a person. You're delegitimized. You don't have any rights or any protection in this area where you are living, and this is your homeland. So torture, extreme torture, is used against Palestinian male prisoners where there are many stress positions that they are subjected to, sleep deprivation, also threats of arresting family members. The charges or the sentences against them are extremely exaggerated and high sentences because it also affects the social dynamics inside Palestine and between the Palestinians. It becomes like most of our youth and most of our influential activists are inside prison. So there's no also leadership for Palestine to move towards the liberation of Palestine. There's always harsh detention conditions are all the same for all prisoners. But yes, the imprisonment of the majority of male Palestinians is to really cut down any hope of a liberated Palestine because there's a majority of the Palestinian population inside prison. There's no hope of continuing this resistance against the occupation.
Malena Ansari is the international advocacy officer with the Al-Damir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association, a Palestinian NGO based in Ramallah, occupied Palestine. For more information about the institutionalized incarceration of Palestinians under Israeli occupation and Al-Damir's advocacy on their behalf, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. For today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
Witness Cynthia Megaris, who had a squelch. Give it all away. What does it mean to bear witness? The act of witnessing is also the act of universal acceptance. Giving is intertwined with wealth and abundance, depending on the reciprocal relationship one has with land and community. It is this ideology that has helped indigenous nations maintain sustenance for centuries. Following Thema Igaris, performance at SFE Gallery in fall 2022, who had a squelch, give it all away. Guest participants were invited to recount the event in, as Igaris describes, a collective remembering, a truth about an experience. Listen as participants Tanya Lucan Linklater, Alisa Johnny Hawkins, and Mikel DeAngeli share their witness encounters together in a conversation airing December 12th and 19th on Speaker from 10 to 11 a.m.